Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today is inaugural day, and we have a very special guest. Her name is Michelle Dean, and we're going to be talking about her book, Saving America's Grace, Rethinking Family Values, Moral Politics, and Cultural Wars. Saving America's Grace presents a progressive moral values framework that challenges typically held assumptions about family values, culture wars, and morality in politics today. Author Michelle Dean tackles taboo subtopics, family, religion, morality, and politics, with intelligence and a powerful sense of purpose. Her manifesto for a better America calls for humanistic values and integrity of character, not the authoritarian values embraced by today's Republican Party or the fundamentalist sexual mores culture warriors obsess over. Saving America's Grace redefines what it means to be a moral society by articulating the progressive values that are the heartbeat of America. It's a clarion call for the left to rally together around shared moral principles and boldly move forward with clearer moral conviction for a better America. For more information, you can visit her website, which is www.michelledean.com, and I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Michelle to the show. Good day, Michelle.
Hi, good day, Robert. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure, and with today's activities going on, boy, it is a perfect time to talk about grace. We certainly need a little
I'll
bit
say.
Of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, let's first start with the, what was the spark or the inspiration for you to write this particular book?
Well, I'm writing about politics, and there's probably not anybody that can be further outside of the beltway than myself. And I consider myself an accidental activist. And how I got involved in this was back in the days of George W. Bush, a lot of family values rhetoric was being used that had a profound influence on voters. Particularly in 2004, the wedge issue of the day was basically, quote, gay marriage was going to pretty much destroy society. And they really worked people up into a lather. And a lot of analysts felt that moral values and family values were what drove people to the polls back in those days, in spite of the fact that Bush had a very low approval rating given our immersion in the unjust war in Iraq. But in spite of all that, with the family values rhetoric, they got people to the polls because people were obviously, and rightly so, are concerned about families. But what they were telling people about families was absolutely incorrect and misguided. And I thought to myself, not on my watch. And that's my background. My background is in human development and family relations. And I'm a marriage and family therapist. And nobody in my profession seemed to be standing up and righting the wrongs that I was hearing. So that's how I got interested in studying this topic further and writing a book.
I think, with today's inauguration, and we're going to talk a little bit later about what happened over the whole election, primary period, and all that kind of thing, and when it comes to values. But particularly now, it seems that It is really important for those who feel that, you know, some of the values that are expressed, that have been expressed over the last 18 months, that if they're contrary to what your values are, that it is so important to be active and vocal. And, you know, and I believe you started the book with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., that our lives begin to end the moment we become silent about things that matter. And it, you know, it seems that silence, we have to make sure we break that silence, and we are not silent during this period.
Exactly. And I think that there's two points that I would like to make about anybody out there who is not happy with our current situation, our new president. And that is, there's two things. I think that it's not just a matter of resisting. There's that phrase, what we resist persists, but it's a matter of fighting for something. And I think this is where Democrats or people on the left have fallen short. They never really, and there's been a lot of books written on the subject, most particularly George Lakoff, who's a cognitive linguist at Berkeley, wrote a book, Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. And he basically identified the whole family values framework that the right has been using since the Reagan years, or a little even before that. And Democrats were always responding, or at best were in a defensive position against this, but they never kind of came up with their own moral values framework. And I believe that we need to be stating what we're for, not just what we're against. So we can complain all we want about Mr. Trump, but if we are not for something, then we are really not in an offensive fighting position.
Yeah, so I agree.
I think we need to start talking about what our moral values are on the left and what we are fighting for.
Yeah, it was interesting when I was watching one of the news stations this morning, and I saw Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer talking, and one of the things he kept stressing was, we are going to stick up for our values, you know, things that go contrary to our values. And I thought, man, this is exactly what Michelle was talking about, you know.
Oh, great.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Let's talk first about, you know, the phrase family values and how it has been co-opted by the right. You know, as far as identifying, you know, certain values that kind of maybe take us back, you know, 40 or 50 years. And so can you, I believe in your book you talk about, you know, family values versus what, you know, true values are. So I can't remember the exact phrase.
Yeah, I talk about values of value. Here's the thing about values. Values can be good or bad. A gang of robbers can have similar values. It doesn't make them necessarily good or bad. And I think that what we need to start doing is defining values in terms of principles. So I ask, what is the goal of family life? And from that point, you work backwards and you develop what your values then will be. If your goal of family life is to have a healthy, a healthy, sound family with strong relationships, and you provide for the optimal development of your children and the rest of the members, then you need to have values that take you to where you want to go. So what I say is we need to start looking at what is the purpose and function of the family. And if your purpose and function of the family is to have a sound, sound relationships, strong, if you want to raise children that are moral and that are, you know, solid and emotionally healthy individuals, we need to ask, what does it take to get there? And what we've all been led to believe is that, quote, traditional family values are the answer. Well, traditional family values aren't even very well defined, but it does evoke in your mind this kind of nostalgic, you know, perfect family life of the 1950s with the white picket fence and, you know, Leave It to Beaver. And that's all well and good if that's, you know, what you want to have. However, that image is not what's going to get you a healthy family life. And that's the image that was that's being sold with traditional family values, but there's not much real there. In other words, a family can look fine or, quote, perfect on the surface, but that doesn't mean it's a well-functioning family or a healthy family. And I learned this lesson right after graduate school. I worked as a therapist in a private psychiatric hospital, a family therapist on an adolescent unit. And, you know, private hospital, doctors, lawyers, you know, it's all the upper class families in the Boston community had, not all of them, but the children from those families were in the psychiatric hospital because they were struggling. It wasn't that they had necessarily psychosis or mental illness, but their souls were, they were struggling individuals, generally because of the strife in the home and the lack of coping skills taught to them, and it pretty much unsound family relationships. So I'm saying we can't look at the surface structure. We can't say that if you need a mother, father, and then your family life is going to be fine, which is what the religious right has been saying. You know, without a mother and father, you're going to... And sure, a mother and father is much more ideal than a single parent family for many reasons, but it's not what makes a family healthy and strong. So I'm trying to get people to see that it's more about the surface, not about the form of the family, it's about the function of the family.
Yeah. And, you know, the basic upbringing, you know, of the children and instilling, you know, beliefs of right and wrong, compassion, respect, you know, those kinds of values can be taught, you know, by either mother or father or single parent. I mean, it's not gender unique, you know, as to what, you know how and what kind of values are instilled in the children.
Exactly. And I did an interview last week with somebody who identified himself as, you know, a child of the 60s, a flower child, and he was given a lot of grief from people because he was in a relationship with this woman and they weren't married. You know, back then it was considered to be kind of a rebellious thing. And people really attacked him for this and made him, you know, attempted to make him feel like he was being immoral. Well, 30 years later, he's still together with this woman. I'm not sure if he's now married to her. But the point I want to make is that relationship any less healthy than a relationship with someone who's married and there's, you know, domestic violence happening in the household? And those are the types of things that we need to start asking, is really what's going on within the relationship. And, you know, the religious right has claimed that gay marriage is going to, you know, is destroying marriage. Now, the two gay lovebirds down the street do not have an impact on anybody else's marriage. Marriage is self-destruct. It's, you know, it's an inside job, whether or not the marriage works or not. And I feel by pushing blame onto homosexuals who want to get married, it really takes the responsibility away from the married couple for whether or not they can make their marriage work. Do you understand what I'm saying about that?
Oh, yeah.
You're taking the responsibility away from where it really lies, and that's in the people who are married. So yeah. Those are the types of things that we need to look at.
Yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, I love that there was one reference you made to the book about a Pew Research poll about, you know, the in the Bible Belt, you know, where religion plays a major part in people's lives, how some of the they have some of the highest rates of divorce, teen pregnancy, these kinds of things that you know that are that would kind of stretch family values. You know that it's in those that particular environment that you know. And I wonder. Right now, I am living in South Carolina. I'm at the in the belt buckle of that Bible Belt. But I spent most of my adult years in California, so you know, and I count myself as left in my politics. So you know, I see the you know the culture difference. I mean, it's a shock. But the one thing that I find is it seems that the dogma that many religious individuals adhere to, you know, the you know, what's right and what's wrong, you know, fire, brimstone, those kinds of things, it seems that those, that dogma is really what creates the dissension, the conflict, and so much of the unhappiness, you know, in many of the people who, you know, if they were to be more compassionate, more respectful, that wouldn't be the case.
Yes, I so are you saying that the well, I think it's a double-edged sword, because I think that the dogma helps give people this feeling of structure. It gives them something to like their guidelines, and I think that helps people feel like they have something. I think that also the community that, you know, their religion might provide them is a fabulous thing.
Right.
However, when you start, what happens oftentimes with religion is that you lose the intention of it.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is a tool to become a better human being. That's basically it. And somebody else said that. I wish I could remember who it was that defined it that way. It might have been the Dalai Lama. But religion, essentially, that's what it is. It's a tool to become a better human being. And if we could remember that and really get down to what was the message of Christ? And, you know, he was not concerned about a lot of the things that the religious right are focusing on today, you know, whether or not transgender people can use this bathroom or that bathroom. And obviously that wasn't an issue back then, but the point is that Jesus was on a mission to bring love into the heart of men, that you treat your neighbor with kindness and love, you know, and we're getting away from that in our culture. And I think that that's one of the biggest moral issues that we have today. It's not about all the below-the-belt issues, like whether we're teaching evolution to children. You know, a lot of people in the Bible Belt don't want to be teaching evolution to children in schools or sex education and that type of thing. That's not where our focus needs to be. Our focus needs to be on character and how we treat one another. And that is my biggest concern with Donald J. Trump, is that what is he representing in our culture and what is he role modeling for the children in our culture about how to behave?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of many of my concerns too. You know, and it seems that, well, you know, in your book, as you went through and looked closely at family values, and also looked, you know, in your book, you have wonderful discussion about the primaries and kind of what went on there. What do you think is it that, you know, Americans really embraced that lower level of I wouldn't say low level, that level of confrontation and disrespect and just disregard, you know, for the value of many you know, groups within the country.
And so, what was your question?
Well, it seemed obviously a lot of Americans felt that, you know, the way he treated people, all that kind of stuff didn't really matter, you know, in the sense,
yeah.
You know, so you know, what makes me wonder is how people could disregard, you know, that lack of respect.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a lot of fear out there. I think people are in a lot of are in desperate situations, and we know that he really tapped into the population that is most struggling in our country. And I think that when people get desperate, they are operating from fear, and it's hard to not be, quote, in fighting mode for oneself. And what that means is you're setting yourself up as, you know, there's going to be an enemy out there. And Trump did a fabulous job of drawing lines in the sand and making enemies of this group or that group or the other group. And the people that were most drawn to that were people who are in a lot of fear, I believe. And and I do want to say also that I sometimes get disgusted just even reading things on the left. I think the left can be just as insensitive as the right. And I'm hoping that the left just tones that down. For example, it was just a ridiculous, I don't know what it was. It was an alternative left e-zine that I was reading, and they were just going on a rant about the fact that Melania, is that how you pronounce the first lady's name?
Yeah.
Was wearing sunglasses yesterday during, you know, the ceremony at the Tomb of Unknown Soldiers. And it's just like, okay, so what? You know, but they were making it, they were really going after it and trying to make it sound like, you know, she, it's just like, it's not important. And don't lower yourself by complaining. You know, it's just, and I think that we're going to need to elevate the conversation from both sides of the aisle and as we go forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. You know, that, and, you know, in your book, you also talked about how the right and the GOP became very good at, if there wasn't something to be fearful of marketing fear, if there wasn't something to be fearful of, you create the fear, and then you also kind of recognize you as the solution to it. So it seemed like there was a lot of, granted, there are things that we should be, you know, concerned about, but to elevate it to create such a high level of fear, it seems that, you know, in this particular election, that it worked. You create the fear, you get the people afraid, you get them to vote for you as a solution. And you know, in using that example of the left, and, you know, it seems like that was another way of creating dissension. You know what I mean? And it seems that, you know, both tactics really just don't do us service, you know, in being able to, you know, kind of lift us up and create a positive environment.
Right. Yeah, that's classic propaganda is, you know, you create fear and then you present yourself as the solution. You know, Hitler did that. It's classic propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
George Bush did that with the, you know, the propaganda around going into Iraq. And then I call, you know, gay marriage became the new weapons of mass destruction. They used that to create fear, and, you know, voting for Bush would save our society from ultimate collapse. So that whole piece is, and I think that, you know, that, I don't know, I think that educating people so that they can see when this is happening is a part of that. It's a part of being able to take back power and control. So we just have to be careful with the propaganda that's going on, and the media has a big job to play as well.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and then add into that, throw into that mix, you know, your fake news and your news for entertainment, or real entertainment. I mean, they can be, you know, quite confusing for people. And I think that, you know, for, you know, whatever it is that, you know, someone will find whatever it is that they want to find, you know, supporting whatever
That's
they want.
Right.
So, I mean, and it's just, I think, you know, like you say, it's extra important for us to be discernible as to what kinds of information is being put out there, you know, where it comes from, and use common sense when it comes to, you know, making our decisions and our choices and feeling. One of the things, part of your book is you talk about, you know, the culture war. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, through the research you did for your book, about, you know, when did differing cultures and cultural experiences become a war?
Well, the academics trace it back to civil rights era, when things really started to shift in America. People started getting very worried. So what we had were you know, equal rights for Black people were coming on, and then we had equal rights for women, and that really, both of those things really kind of disrupted the patriarchal system. And that was, they believe that that was kind of the beginnings of these culture, of this, quote, culture war. And then it became a thing, you know, kind of defined when Pat Buchanan at the, 1992 Republican National Convention, I believe, you know, pretty much stated, "My friends, we're in a culture war for the soul of our country." And he kind of declared war at that time. And then it became, it's become rhetoric, and it's become something that the right has used to divide. You know, it's like, again, that classic war strategy is you divide and conquer. So they're figuring out ways to divide our culture. And Thomas Frank wrote a book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And his whole thing was how brilliant the Republicans have been to get the middle of the country to vote against their own best economic interests, and how they did that was by creating this culture war between them and the coasts, you know, the lefties on the coast.
Right.
And that's how it's been, again, a lot of political rhetoric that's been combined, it's been used in a genius way, I have to say, give credit to the right. But they have had decades of think tanks and hundreds of millions of dollars funneled into places like Focus on the Family that have made it their mission to create this culture war. And their war has been for traditional family values. Now, what they mean by that is they want to legislate fundamentalist biblical beliefs. That's what their ultimate goal is in this culture war. They never state that, because we live in a democracy and that's very anti-American, but that is exactly what their goal is, whether they're trying to create laws that prevent, again, gay people from getting married, or whether they're trying to prevent, you know, people from having, you know, sex education in the schools, or whether they're trying to prevent, you know, the teaching of revolution.
Abortion rights.
So it doesn't
matter. You know. Yeah.
Yes. What was the? What did you say? I didn't catch that.
I said abortion rights or a woman's rights.
Abortion
to
rights.
What to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that is what their ultimate goal is to legislate these biblical beliefs. And now we have a different name for it, different packaging, same war. Now, since marriage equality passed, I think that they began to see that that's no longer their avenue. And they switched it to a fight for religious liberty. That's the new branding of this culture war. You know, and they don't like the fact that, you know, they want to be able to have people basically, what's the word I want, be able to, you know, not provide services, business services to, you know, gay couples who want to get married and that type of thing. So it's a fight for religious liberty that they're now, that's how they're now branding their culture war.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you lose one battle, you start another one. And, yeah, it's I can see that happening. And, you know, with the, you know, the one thing that, you know, that I got from reading your book was, you know, how important it is to kind of, you know, strip away all of the, you know, all of the noise, you know, and really get down to, you know, what the values are, you know, basically what the founding fathers are, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know, and you know, and keeping, you know, separation of church and state, those kinds of things that, you know, are trying to be blurred right now. And you know, and really we kind of need to fight for that. So now, you know, with a cultural war, you know, and when we, now that we have, you know, a president and it looks like a cabinet who are going to be, you know, instituting laws and direction that runs contrary to a lot of liberty, do you think that the way for the progressive or the left to be able to counter that influence is just the constant hammering about values and recognizing that what, you know, what's contrary to American values, the core American values?
I do think so. I'm not sure it's hammering, but maybe I think that we need a narrative, a moral narrative, that really draws us back to what are American values. And it boils down to freedom, equality, and the common good. And we need to constantly be asking ourselves if our government is supporting freedom, equality, and the common good. That's the basis of our country, our American values. And and we can see that a lot of this is not being supported in so far in the words that Trump has spoken, whether in the during the primaries and on the campaign trail, or even in the first stint of presidency with his cabinet picks. So right. I do believe, yeah, that's absolutely it. Now here's the trick. here's something that I've been kind of going off on recently, is this notion of the common good. This is precisely why our founders knew that democracy requires virtue. It's a spiritual concept that requires moral values in order to execute. Because you have to be virtuous, you have to have the moral sensibility to be able to put the common good before your own self-serving interests. And we have not seen that in our president. In fact, he has epitomized all that is not that. It's all been about self-serving interests. And quite frankly, I think that this is the horrible thing about Donald Trump, and this is also the blessing in disguise, because what he does epitomize has been capitalistic values run amok. He epitomizes the problem that we have in this culture with valuing money over human values. And, I mean, in everything about him, he will run over anybody to get where he wants to go, as we saw. And my feeling is that if we want to have a more sound culture, a healthier culture, we need to have character in our citizenship. And, of course, in our leaders. So that's where we need to be focusing our moral values, our energy on how do we develop a better society. It has to do with quality of character. It has to do with the golden rule. It has to do with how we treat one another. And again, this even ties into our American values, because this is how a society and a government work, a democratic government work.
Yeah, I found it interesting. In your book, you mentioned that when Pope Francis was here and speaking to our leaders, he indicated that it was important not to put love of money over love of humanity. And, I mean, you know, and you look at the cabinet, and it's, you know, that's what that's what the majority, you know, their focus has been, you know, it seems that, you know, this pendulum has swung, you know, and right now it's like way to the right. So do you think that just the fact that it's there and that we're going to be seeing, you know, so many things run contrary to what some basic American values have been, that that's going to be kind of the spark in a way of igniting, you know, those who, you know, in opposition. So that's kind of, because one of the things that I've thought is that, you know, this shows the other side of the spectrum and exactly, you know, what comes of it, you know, the fights he's picking and the results that are going to happen. It's going to, I think, you know, just show us and the world exactly what that kind of view, the self-centered, satisfying, what it rots, you know, the kind of results that it brings. So I guess in a way, this to me, it seems like it's going to highlight, you know, this is what you want. Mm-hmm. You do it this way, this is what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I look at it that way. I try to think of this as a crisis. You know, the Chinese symbol for crisis is the same one as for opportunity. And I'm just praying that this crisis is really an opportunity for us to get back on track as a country. And I know I'm going to personally be doing all I can to develop this moral narrative and to get this moral narrative out there so that people can start to understand why this is important and why we're so off track and what we need to do to get back on track. And I do think that, you know, we're going to be, he's going to be in the spotlight, but in whether or not this administration makes progress these next 4 years is really going to weigh heavily on the Republicans, because it's all about them. They, you know, they control the houses and they've got the president there. So I do think that there's going to be a day of reckoning, and I just because I'm an optimist, I do believe that this could be an opportunity.
I agree. You know, and that's the only thing that gets me through the day, recognizing that, you know, there is, you know, that whatever happens, I mean, you know, we'll survive, you know, and ultimately, you know, we may have some bumps and bruises, but ultimately we're going to be better for it, however it shakes out, because we do have the checks, even though there are fewer checks and balances with them in control of everything, but it's, you know, that I have faith, you know, in the American people to being able to stand up.
Yeah, and also on the leaders on the left, we really need to get organized here and figure out what they are fighting for. You know, Bernie Sanders, he spoke to a lot of people, and he spoke from the heart to the heart. You know, he knows. He doesn't have a full moral narrative going, but he's speaking on the level of moral values. And he even said, we need to change our culture. And he pointed to his head when he said that. And it is about these values. We flipped upside down. Rather than the cream rising to the top of our political ladder, we've had the moral and ethical dregs right to the top. And that's how upside down our values are in this culture. It's we are too much valuing profit over people to be, you know, and who is it benefiting? It's benefiting the people in power. It is not benefiting the population. And that's how we all need to pull together, whether we're working class, middle class, you know, black, brown, woman, man. It doesn't matter. It's all the common good is how we need to phrase this. And, you know, get out of our little identity politics and pull together under a common moral umbrella, which is the common good.
Yeah. You know, I believe that, you know, once people are more secure in their, you know, in their living, you know, that they're not fearful, it's kind of like the Maslow's, you know, you kind of take care of your basic needs first, you know. So, you know, once you're kind of take care of those basic needs of, you know, health and home, you know, then you tend to be more, you know, open, you know, to recognizing, you know, and helping others. I mean, I just think that's kind of a basic human thing. And you know,
that's
so.
That's a really good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, we're down toward the end of the show, Michelle. It went by quickly. I didn't take a break. We didn't have anybody in the queue, but I just wanted to keep talking to you.
Absolutely.
So now, you know, what is it, you know, that, I mean, first of all, you obviously feel that we can change, we can make a difference, and we can make a positive impact toward saving America's grace. So, you know, what would you be maybe your clarion call, you know, to the people, to the readers, you know, and to those out there who want to be able to make a difference and get us on a more compassionate, respectful, thoughtful path?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's two or three things. One is for the left, the leaders, the activists, people like that, I believe we have to start looking at the big picture and pull together. We've been divided too much into people who are interested in environment, climate change, and people are interested in immigration, people are interested in women's issues, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it really is under the common umbrella of altruism versus this authoritarian moral paradigm that we're seeing on the right today. And so we need to figure out a way to talk about it that engages people. That's one thing. On the level of citizenship, we need to start asking ourselves what does really make us happy? And it's not, you know, and I feel like we've gotten ourselves into this groove, if you can call it that. It's a rat race of, you know, people are needing to work two jobs, or we have, you know, both parents in a household working, commuting, not having time for children. Our whole system is messed up. You know, no longer can one parent support a middle-class household anymore. It used to be the case. And I talk about this in my book, that this is one of the reasons nuclear families are breaking up. You know, it's a failure to navigate the emotional and practical stresses of everyday life. And that is, and there's, I think, a tremendous amount of stress placed on nuclear families today. For 99% of our time on this earth, we've lived in hunter-gatherer society where the ratio of adults to children is 4-1. It's like reversed today, practically. And that's a problem. We don't have communities. We don't have villages anymore that help us with these types of things. So not only that, but we have two parents who are working. So I think that on that level, we need to start rethinking our values and our culture, as well as having the politicians straighten out the economic injustice that's going on. We really do need to take care of that. Bernie Sanders is absolutely right. How we do that, you know, needs to be figured out. But that is an absolute problem. And then the last thing I would want to say is that we really need to think, and I address this in my book. I have a few chapters on what I call building children from the inside out. And we need to figure out, we need to help our children develop as healthy, sound, independent, happy souls. How do we do that? And it's not by, you know, what we've been focusing on is, you know, you get them in soccer, you get them in violin lessons, you make sure that they're you know, have tutoring for, at least in the upper middle class, you know, they're focusing on all these crazy things that are just stressing kids out today. And we need to start back at the basics of what kids really need and on an emotional level. And the way that we do create a healthier child is by addressing their emotional needs as a parent. Yeah. And I do go into that with the book. Unfortunately, it would probably be a good topic for another show. But that's an important piece, that we can start to raise our children differently than the culture is telling us. And I think that that's an important message.
Yeah, I agree. So I agree. You know, and you know, and it's that that lack of community and change in focus, you know, that I think, you know, leads to, you know, children not recognizing, you know, compassion amongst each other, you know, result cyberbullying, lack of respect, you know, for authority or institutions. And, you know, so, and it seems that, you know, like, for example, you mentioned like soccer or football, you know, rather than focusing on winning and what the scholarships are going to bring, right, you know, the focus should be on teamwork and, you know, working, you know, that kind of thing. So it's kind of like, you know, and keeping in mind what the goal should be.
Right. And even younger kids, just let them play free from. They don't need coaches yelling at them when they're 5 years old.
Really?
I know. So play. Just let them play. But anyway, another big mission of mine is highlighting the abnormal norms in our culture, and that's one of them that I just mentioned. But there's a whole other, and I hope to start a blog on that someday. But
it's a kind of a kept point, abnormal norms.
Yeah. Absolutely. Maybe I should name the blog that.
A paradox. I think so. Well, this has really been great, Michelle. I really have enjoyed talking with you. Again, I enjoyed reading the book. Once I read it, and then, you know, I'm a news hound, so I kind of, and I've watched, you know, what you wrote about, you know, kind of play out on the stage, you know, and it's it's just fascinating. You know, it kind of, it raised my awareness, you know, and it got me thinking and being a little bit more discerning. So I think that's one of the wonderful benefits from your book.
That's great. I'm glad that that's what I was hoping for it to do. So it's available on Amazon if anybody's interested. Saving America's Grace, and hopefully we can talk again sometime.
I would like that. I follow you on Twitter and liked your Facebook page, so I'll keep in touch that way. So, again, I appreciate you your time today.
Yeah, well, thank you, Robert. I appreciate you having me.
It's my pleasure. Okay, great. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Michelle Dean. She is author of Saving America's Grace, Rethinking Family Values, Moral Politics, and Cultural Wars. And as she mentioned, her book is available at Amazon.com. And you can also find out more information about Michelle by visiting her website, which is www.michelledean.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.